I think that in order to stop any speculation or to deal with the possibility that there's going to be speculation about some connection between Ferry's death and this performance that Mr. Garrison is putting on down in New Orleans, that Mr. Garrison ought now to indicate in a forthright public statement just exactly what Mr. Ferry contributed to this investigation, in quotes, that he's conducting. And I note from one of these wire service releases here that Ferry himself called Garrison's probe, quote, a big joke, unquote. I think Mr. Garrison ought to tell us exactly what connection Mr. Ferry has with this and tell us very clearly so that we don't have to get involved in speculation as to whether he's found anything more out about Ferry or not.
You feel then that there's absolutely no foundation to the stories or the investigation which Mr. Garrison is conducting in New Orleans?
I'll say this for sure. On the basis of the FBI reports that we examined about Ferry at the time, and the FBI conducted a thorough investigation of any possible involvement of this man, there was absolutely no reason to believe that there was any connection between Mr. Ferry and the assassination of the president. And I've seen nothing that would lead me to change my mind. If Mr. Garrison's got something that would change those facts, then we ought to know about it. And we ought to know about it right now.
That's the former Warren Commission attorney, Wesley Liebler, speaking to a reporter on February the 23rd, 1967, the day after the death of David Ferry in New Orleans. Just a few days before Ferry died, the newspapers had reported that he was the prime suspect in a major investigation into the Kennedy assassination that had been launched by the New Orleans District Attorney, Jim Garrison. You can hear the rage in Wesley Liebler's voice in that clip as he talks about this performance that Mr. Garrison is putting on down in New Orleans. You can hear his contempt for Garrison's very public claims that he'd finally solved the supposed mystery of Kennedy's murder. Liebler himself had looked into the David Ferry angle 3 years earlier when the Warren Commission was conducting its investigation into Kennedy's murder, and as Liebler angrily said in that clip, his own investigation into the Ferry angle had given the Warren Commission absolutely no reason to believe that there was any connection between Mr. Ferry and the assassination of the president. If Jim Garrison had found some new evidence suggesting that there was a Ferry connection, Liebler was daring him to come out with that evidence now. He was daring him to put up or shut up. When Wesley Liebler made these comments on February the 23rd, the public phase of Jim Garrison's Kennedy probe had only just begun. It was less than a week since Garrison had formally confirmed that his office was investigating the assassination. But already Garrison's investigation was starting to look like a bit of a circus. In the previous episode, we talked in detail about the death of David Ferry and about the whirlwind sequence of events that had happened just before his death and just after it. But let's quickly recap those events now. On February the 17th, a New Orleans newspaper broke the news of Garrison's secret Kennedy probe. The next day, David Ferry outed himself in that same newspaper as Jim Garrison's prime suspect. 2 days later, Garrison held a press conference where he castigated the newspapers for compromising his investigation and where he made the apparently fanciful suggestion that the publication of David Ferry's name might have put Ferry's life in danger. 2 days after that, Ferry was found dead in his apartment. Garrison then held another press conference where he claimed that Ferry's death had been a suicide. This claim wasn't true. The coroner would find that David Ferry had died of an aneurysm. There were no drugs in his system and no other indications of suicide. Garrison's claim that Ferry had killed himself was an early example of Garrison's inability to notice that there was any difference between what he personally wanted to be true and what was true. When David Ferry died, there was a widespread sense of relief among the staff in Jim Garrison's office. They knew that Garrison had never had any real evidence against Ferry and that his Kennedy conspiracy theories were getting dangerously out of hand. So when his prime suspect suddenly dropped dead, Garrison's aides hoped and expected that Garrison would use that as a convenient excuse to shut down his Kennedy probe without having to admit defeat and without anybody else getting hurt. But 2 days after Ferry's death, Garrison rashly doubled down on his Kennedy obsession. He held yet another one of his press conferences, and he announced that his investigation would go on. He said that he already had other suspects in his sights and that the only way they could evade justice would be to commit suicide too, as he falsely claimed that David Ferry had. Garrison said, quote, "We are going to be able to arrest every person involved, at least every person who is still living. I'm sure that there will be convictions." Just 5 days after saying that, Garrison arrested the prominent New Orleans businessman Clay Shaw and very publicly charged him with having conspired to murder President Kennedy. Many of Garrison's staffers were horrified when that happened. Garrison's so-called case against David Ferry had been farcical enough, but his case against Clay Shaw was flat-out non-existent. As one of Garrison's aides said later, when Garrison suddenly decided to arrest Shaw, that was the moment when the people around him realized that Garrison's Kennedy fixation was more than a matter of political opportunism. There was also madness here, said Garrison's assistant. When Garrison arrested Clay Shaw, he crossed the Rubicon. There was no turning back. He had nowhere to go except deeper and deeper into the almost incredible clusterfuck that he'd set in motion. And unfortunately, the man who was going to pay the most for Garrison's act of madness wasn't Garrison himself. It was Clay Shaw, the man who'd suddenly found himself starring in a Kafka novel, accused of committing a crime that he'd had absolutely nothing to do with. My name is David Free, and this is The Ghosts of Dallas. On the face of it, the suggestion that Clay Shaw was the kind of man who would assassinate a president appeared to be pretty absurd, to put it mildly. Shaw was a dignified and cultured and thoroughly respectable New Orleans citizen. He was 53 years old, he was craggily good-looking, with a shock of fluffy white hair. He was a published playwright, and he was well-known around New Orleans for his work restoring some of the city's most attractive historic buildings. And as a businessman and civic leader, he'd been one of the founders of the city's international trademark. Shaw was gay, and he was in the closet, as most gay people were in that time and place. Jim Garrison was aware of Shaw's sexuality, and it became a central factor in his persecution of Shaw, no doubt because of the fact that Garrison was a repressed and closeted gay man himself, as we saw in episode 13. In Garrison's mind, Shaw's concealed sexuality meant that he was exactly the kind of twisted individual who would have conspired to assassinate a president. It didn't matter to Garrison that there was no serious objective evidence that proved this. Garrison set about simply manufacturing a case against Shaw out of thin air, using a series of increasingly desperate measures, including coercion of witnesses, bribery, extortion, forgery, and threats of physical violence. But why was it that Garrison felt the need to manufacture a case against Clay Shaw in particular, as opposed to any other gay New Orleans scapegoat? How had this respectable New Orleans citizen come to be in Jim Garrison's sights at all? Why was it that when David Ferry died, Clay Shaw was already sitting there on the back burner of Garrison's investigation, so that he could almost instantly be moved to the front burner and promoted in the space of just a few days to the position of Garrison's new prime suspect? To understand how Clay Shaw first became part of this story, we need to go back to the day of Kennedy's death, and we need to talk about this man.
I'm not in a position to comment. I'm under closure because of a court order directing those persons involved, the principals, that is, prohibiting comment.
That's a colourful New Orleans attorney named Dean Andrews, a man who was going to be central to the fate of Clay Shaw. Dean Andrews was a good-humoured, jive-talking lawyer who was quite overweight and rotund. In the straight-talking 1960s, people around New Orleans generally called him the fat man. As a kind of personal trademark, Andrews always wore a pair of dark glasses. I've seen many archival TV and film interviews with Andrews, and I've never seen him not wearing his sunglasses. In Oliver Stone's JFK, Dean Andrews is played by John Candy, who puts in one of the film's better and less malicious performances. I'm going to play you another clip now of the real Dean Andrews in action. I promise you that Andrews is talking English in this clip, although it's not going to sound like it. If you don't understand a word he says, don't worry. I'm going to play this clip again later in its proper context, and I'm going to explain what he's talking about. For the moment, I'm playing it just to give you an idea of his jive-talking personal style.
So he's kosher. I don't know what he's up to. He's picking me like chicken, shucking me like corn, stewing me like an oyster. I mean, he ain't put nothing down but air, so I'll give him two names, see which way he's going.
Dean Andrews was a flamboyant character, and he was well known around New Orleans as a joker and entertainer. He ran a small-time law practice, and he specialized in representing pimps, prostitutes, and members of the city's gay community. At the time of the Kennedy assassination, Andrews was working as a part-time assistant DA in Jefferson Parish, which was next door to Jim Garrison's turf of Orleans Parish. Andrews was an old friend of Jim Garrison's. They'd been to law school together. "I like Dean," Garrison said once. "Everyone does." Dean Andrews was known to love the limelight, and he wasn't above telling little fibs and fables to get attention for himself. This tendency was considered harmless and even entertaining by his friends in New Orleans until the assassination of Kennedy. But when Andrews decided to start telling tall stories about some alleged encounters that he'd had with Lee Harvey Oswald, he was playing with fire. He set off a chain of events that he couldn't control, and those events wound up destroying not only Andrews himself, but also the unfortunate Clay Shaw. The events I'm talking about began on the day of Kennedy's assassination. Dean Andrews was in hospital that day. He was suffering from a very bad bout of pneumonia that would end up keeping him in hospital for a total of around 10 days. On the afternoon of the assassination, Andrews was feverish and heavily medicated. He had a TV in his room, and he watched as the news of Kennedy's death and Oswald's arrest rolled in over that long afternoon and evening of Friday the 22nd. Andrews also had a telephone in his room, although his doctor said later on that he was surprised that Andrews could even talk on the phone given how heavily sedated he was. Unfortunately for everyone involved, though, Andrews did have several drugged-up telephone conversations over the next couple of days. The first of these occurred the day after the assassination. A friend phoned Andrews in his room, and they talked about the events of the previous day. At some point in this conversation, Andrews said something about how great it would be for his legal career if somehow he could be hired to go and represent Lee Harvey Oswald in Dallas. Since Andrews was so heavily medicated, he could never remember the exact details of this phone conversation afterwards. He said later, "I don't know whether I suggested, man, I would be famous if I could go to Dallas and defend Lee Harvey Oswald. Whoever gets that job is going to be a famous lawyer," or if the idea just came about in the course of the conversation. Either way, this hazy fantasy of Andrews began to snowball before the day was over. Sometime that afternoon, he rang his secretary at home, and he told her that he had been hired to represent Lee Harvey Oswald. He told her that somebody had telephoned him earlier that day to make the request. When his secretary asked him who had made this phone call on Oswald's behalf, Andrews had to make up a name out of thin air. He said that the phone call had come from a man he vaguely knew, whose name was Bertrand. At this stage, Andrews was so zorched on medications that it's unclear if he knew that he was lying when he told his secretary that. Even Andrews himself was never clear on this point. As he said later, he was so out of it at the time that, quote, "I might have believed it myself." As we've seen time and again in this podcast, the Kennedy case has always been a magnet for liars and ratbags. From the moment Kennedy was shot, fabulists and dreamers all over America started making up stories about the assassination so they could give themselves their own little walk-on parts in the national drama. Some of these fabulists got lucky, or maybe unlucky. Their dreams came true, and they really did become part of the assassination story. The biggest example of this was Jack Ruby. Ruby wanted to insert himself into the drama as a Jewish American hero, and that's why he shot Oswald. And as we saw in the previous episode of the podcast, a shambolic drunk named Jack Martin pulled off a smaller scale version of the same trick in New Orleans. Martin started telling people that his arch enemy David Ferry had been designated to act as Oswald's getaway pilot after the assassination. And even though the FBI and the Secret Service quickly worked out that Martin was lying, when Jim Garrison took a fresh look at his story a few years later, he swallowed the story hook, line, and sinker. In this episode, we're going to see that Dean Andrews' role in the Clay Shaw saga was almost identical to the role that Jack Martin played in the David Ferry saga. If it wasn't for the drug-fueled Oswald fantasies that Dean Andrews came up with in his hospital bed, the unfortunate Clay Shaw would never have been dragged into the assassination story at all. And as was the case with Jack Martin, it was Jim Garrison who was to blame for weaponizing Dean Andrews' tall stories about the assassination. 3 years after Andrews made up his story about being hired to represent Oswald by the mysterious Bertrand, Jim Garrison revived that story, and he used it as a weapon to take down the innocent Clay Shaw, the man who by then had replaced the late David Ferry as the focal point of Garrison's own assassination fantasies. But let's go back to Dean Andrews' hospital room in November 1963. The day after Andrews told his secretary that he'd been hired to represent Lee Harvey Oswald, Oswald was shot dead by Jack Ruby. For Dean Andrews, this development was a bit of a godsend. It meant that nobody would now have to know that he really hadn't been hired to represent Oswald. He was free to keep telling people that he had been, and he was free to invent a few additional lies about himself and Oswald, which Oswald was now a bit too dead to argue with. Andrews was still in hospital when Oswald was shot, and he was still apparently quite out of it because he proceeded to do something pretty stupid, which he would bitterly regret later on. He picked up his bedside phone and rang the local offices of the FBI and the Secret Service and told them that he had some possibly useful information to offer them about Oswald's activities in New Orleans. He told them that Oswald had visited his office 3 times when he was living in New Orleans and had asked Andrews to help him with a couple of legal problems. He wanted Andrews to help him get his military discharge changed from dishonorable to honorable, and he wanted him to help his wife Marina sort out some citizenship issues. Andrews claimed that when Oswald came to his office, he was accompanied by, quote, approximately 5 male persons, some of whom appeared to be Cuban and all of whom appeared to be gay. Andrews said that although he couldn't remember for sure, it was possible that one of these gay sidekicks of Oswald was the mysterious Bertrand, the same man who would hire him to defend Oswald after the assassination. Andrews claimed to have met this Bertrand character in person a couple of times in the course of his work. He said he was about 22 years old, had blonde hair, and was about 5'7" tall. He also said that he, quote, believed that Bertrand was homosexual. Finally, he added the fatal detail that would bring Clay Shaw into this story. When he was asked what Bertrand's first name was, Andrews said that it was Clay. This detail was going to be very bad news for Clay Shaw when Jim Garrison started using his detective skills on the Kennedy case and on the claims of Dean Andrews, but it would be another 3 years before Garrison started doing that. In November 1963, Dean Andrews' story was just one of the many thousands of bogus leads that the FBI and the Secret Service were obliged to investigate in the days immediately following Kennedy's assassination. When they looked into Andrew's story at that time, neither of those agencies made any connection between Clay Bertrand and Clay Shaw. When the FBI tried to track down Clay Bertrand in New Orleans, they couldn't locate any man of that name. Finally, they re-interviewed Dean Andrews in his office after he'd been discharged from hospital. And now that he'd recovered, Andrews admitted that he'd been so out of it in the hospital that he could no longer even remember having placed those phone calls to the FBI and the Secret Service. Nor could he explain why he'd told his secretary that a man named Bertrand had hired him to represent Lee Harvey Oswald. The supposed phone call from Clay Bertrand now felt like a dream to him, Andrews admitted. In fact, he was now inclined to believe that the Bertrand phone call had been, quote, a figment of his imagination, which he'd dreamed up under the influence of his medication. If this part of the story is giving you flashbacks to the previous episode of the podcast, I don't blame you, because this is exactly what Jack Martin ended up saying when the FBI drilled down on his allegations about David Ferry. Martin used exactly the same phrase. He admitted that his stories about Ferry had been a figment of his imagination. And now Dean Andrews was admitting exactly the same thing about that alleged phone call from Clay Bertrand. The author Patricia Lambert wrote an excellent book about the Shaw case called False Witness, which has been my central source for these episodes of the podcast. And in her book, Lambert refers to Jack Martin and Dean Andrews as the first fathers of Jim Garrison's case, because it was their stories that inspired Garrison to identify the two prime suspects that he built his investigation around. First, David Ferry, and then Clay Shaw. So the whole edifice of Garrison's investigation in 1966 was built on stories that Martin and Andrews had already admitted back in 1963, after some not very rigorous questioning from the FBI, were nothing but figments of their respective imaginations. Mind you, Dean Andrews didn't come completely clean to the FBI when they interviewed him in December 1963. Although he admitted that Clay Bertrand's phone call had been a figment of his imagination, he didn't go all the way and admit that Clay Bertrand himself was a figment of his imagination too. He also stuck by his false claim that Oswald had come to his office several times in the summer of 1963 in the company of a bunch of unidentified gay men. He didn't admit that this story too was a figment of his imagination, and that in truth he'd never known Oswald at all. As Patricia Lambert puts it in False Witness, Andrews, quote, managed to salvage a bit of self-respect by retaining the part about Oswald visiting his office. Admitting the truth about the call from Bertrand was necessary to dislodge the FBI from his doorstep, but he had no reason to admit he fabricated this other complex backstory with its elaborate supporting cast. No one could refute him, and it no doubt seemed harmless enough. It also softened the humiliation by lending some face-saving substance to the whole god-awful mess. End quote. When the Warren Commission began its investigation into Kennedy's murder in December 1963, it diligently re-examined many leads that the FBI had already run down, including the Dean Andrews lead. In July 1964, Andrews was called to testify to the Warren Commission. His testimony was taken by Wesley Liebler, and it was a real dog's breakfast. Under questioning from Liebler, Andrews decided to change his story about Clay Bertrand yet again. He tried to tell Liebler that somebody named Clay Bertrand had indeed called him in his hospital bed and had indeed hired him to represent Oswald. When Liebler reminded Andrews that he'd already told the FBI that this story was a figment of his imagination, Andrews explained that he'd lied to the FBI to get them off his back. Mind you, Andrews still didn't sound all that convinced about the reality of the Bertrand phone call. He admitted to Liebler that the whole incident often felt to him, quote, like a nightmare or a dream, and that he would be ready to concede that the phone call had never really happened if it wasn't for the fact that his secretary remembered him calling her from his hospital bed and telling her that it had happened. If it wasn't for that, Andrews told Liebler, I would just say that I have a pretty vivid imagination, and let's forget it. As for who Clay Bertrand was, Andrews told Liebler that he'd never known him all that well. He was mostly a voice on the phone, he said. He'd only ever seen Bertrand in the flesh twice. The second of these occasions was quite recent. Just a few weeks earlier, Andrews said he'd seen Bertrand in a bar, and he'd tried to ring the FBI so that they could come in and apprehend him, but Bertrand had taken off before Andrews could make that phone call. He really took off, that rascal, Andrews said. I should have grabbed him right there. I probably will never see him again. When the Warren Report was published, it had a whole paragraph in it about Dean Andrews, and what it had to say about him was not all that complimentary. It said, quote, the Commission has noted the testimony of Dean Andrews, an attorney in New Orleans. Andrews stated that Oswald came to his office several times in the summer of 1963. Andrews, who believed that he was contacted on November the 23rd to represent Oswald, testified that Oswald was always accompanied by a Mexican and was at times accompanied by apparent homosexuals. Andrews was able to locate no records of any of Oswald's alleged visits, and investigation has failed to locate the person who supposedly called Andrews on November the 23rd at a time when Andrews was under heavy sedation. End quote. That was where Dean Andrews' 15 minutes of fame really should have ended, in September 1964, when the Warren Commission concluded that there was no evidence at all to support his fanciful stories. But cut to 2 years later, in New Orleans. In November 1966, Jim Garrison was in his second term as DA, and he was in deep political trouble. In his first term, he'd conducted a very popular crusade against petty crime, but a year into his second term, the newspapers were starting to turn against him. People were starting to realise that although Garrison was tough on petty crime, he seemed to be soft on organised crime. Worse still, one newspaper had just reported that somebody in Garrison's office had been taking bribes. So Garrison badly needed to find some new cause or crusade in October 1966. And as it happened, this was the moment when the first big wave of JFK conspiracy theory was breaking in America. The first best-selling conspiracy books were published in the summer of 1966, including Edward Epstein's Inquest and Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment. Hundreds of thousands of Americans had read these books, including Jim Garrison. And Garrison was aware that according to some of the conspiratorial authors, the key to the whole Kennedy conspiracy lay in the six-month period that Oswald had spent living in New Orleans just before the assassination, between April and September of 1963. This was a question that Garrison, as the New Orleans district attorney, was ideally positioned to investigate, and maybe even to go on a big new public crusade about. Garrison knew that his old law school buddy Dean Andrews had been mentioned in the Warren Report and in several of the conspiratorial books. So one night in October 1966, Garrison got the ball rolling on his Kennedy probe by inviting Dean Andrews to dinner at Broussard's restaurant in the French Quarter of New Orleans. This dinner with Andrews was the very opening move in Garrison's Kennedy probe. It happened several weeks before Garrison brought Jack Martin in for questioning and set about reanimating his long-dead allegations about David Ferry. When Garrison and Andrews met for dinner, Garrison brought along a copy of Harold Weisberg's Whitewash, which was another key work in that first wave of JFK conspiracy books. Garrison had this book on the table, and he kept looking things up in it as they ate. This has always struck me as a quite eloquent fact. It's symbolic of how pivotal those early conspiracy theory books were to the grotesque farce that Garrison was about to engage in. over dinner at Broussard's, Garrison told Andrews that he considered him to be, quote, an overlooked witness. Being a fan of Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment, Garrison knew that Lane had poured scorn on the Warren Commission in that book for the way it had dismissed Andrews' stories about Oswald and Clay Bertrand. Lane believed, or at least claimed to believe, that Andrews really had known Oswald and that he might be in possession of explosive information about the true meaning of the assassination. Here's some audio of Lane spinning that particular line of bullshit to a reporter.
In my book, I make reference to the matter of some strange meetings which took place in New Orleans and activities which emanated from there, evidently. Dean Andrews, who was an attorney in New Orleans, who knew Oswald, who knew of Oswald's relationships with the Cubans in the area, agreed to speak with me and to participate in a filmed interview for our film. But when we arrived at his office, he said he had received word from Washington that he would be in serious trouble, might even suffer physical harm if he did grant an interview to us.
When Jim Garrison took Dean Andrews to dinner at Broussard's, he quizzed him about the identity of Clay Bertrand. He wanted to know if Andrews could tell him something new about Bertrand, something more than he'd told the Warren Commission. But Andrews said that he couldn't help him. In fact, that first meeting with Dean Andrews was a bit of a bust for Garrison. He only got one thing out of it, which was that he asked Andrews if he could mooch his personal copy of the Warren Report, because at that stage Garrison didn't even have a copy of his own. Over the next couple of weeks, Garrison looked for other possible New Orleans assassination angles to latch onto, and he kept coming back to Dean Andrews for help. He asked Andrews if he knew anything about David Ferry, for example. Andrews said that he'd only ever met Ferry once when he was helping a friend of Ferry's get parole. Other than that, he knew nothing about him. Garrison also asked if Andrews could give him some information about the Mexican who he'd mentioned in his Warren Commission testimony. Andrews had told the Warren Commission that a stocky Mexican man had always accompanied Oswald on his visits to his office, and in his testimony Andrews had described this man as Oswald's shadow. So naturally Garrison was keen to work out who this man was, but Andrews said that he couldn't help him on that either. And he still couldn't tell Garrison anything more about the identity of Clay Bertrand. But Garrison was already working on a little theory of his own about Clay Bertrand. By the end of 1966, Garrison had gone all chips in on David Ferry as a suspect. He was by now fully convinced that Ferry had been a key player in the assassination. He was also convinced that the crime had been motivated entirely by Ferry's gayness. Kennedy's assassination was a homosexual thrill killing, Garrison started telling people. JFK was handsome, popular, virile, and therefore everything that David Ferry was not, and Ferry had gotten a huge sexual charge out of plotting his murder. Lee Harvey Oswald had been gay too, according to Garrison, and if Dean Andrews was right, the mysterious Clay Bertrand was also gay. For Garrison, that was proof enough that Bertrand must have been in on David Ferry's gay conspiracy too. And once Garrison had made that leap, he found it quite easy to make another leap and decide that he now knew who Clay Bertrand really was. A few days before Christmas 1966, Garrison told a pair of reporters from Life magazine that he'd made a major breakthrough in the case. Life was collaborating with Garrison on a big story about his secret investigation. He was giving the magazine the inside story on what he was up to, on the proviso that Life wouldn't break the story until Garrison was ready to go public. Garrison fully expected to appear on the magazine's cover when that happened. Anyway, a few days before Christmas, he called the Life reporters into his office, and he told them that he'd finally worked out who Clay Bertrand was. There was a photograph turned face down on the desk in front of Garrison, and he now dramatically flipped it over. It was a photograph of Clay Shaw. Clay Shaw, Garrison announced, was Clay Bertrand. When the reporters asked him how he knew this, Garrison said that he'd, quote, deduced it from three important clues. One, Garrison said, Bertrand is homosexual. Two, Bertrand speaks Spanish. Three, his first name is Clay. And that apparently was it. On the basis of those three pieces of information, Garrison had decided that Clay Bertrand and Clay Shaw must be one and the same person. For one of the reporters from Life, this moment with Garrison was a turning point. The reporter had already heard from some of Garrison's aides that the DA had, quote, gone nuts. Now he understood that this might be literally true. Garrison's belief that Clay Shaw was Clay Bertrand was not based on anything that a sane DA would have viewed as evidence. It was complete guesswork, and it was more than a little creepy that Garrison seemed to think of it as some kind of objective breakthrough. Garrison's feat of deduction about Clay Shaw didn't go down all that well with his own staff either. One of his aides pointed out that Dean Andrews had described Clay Bertrand as being 22 years old, 5'7" tall, with sandy hair, whereas Clay Shaw was 53 years old, 6'4" tall, and had a shock of grey hair. Garrison had a reply for that. He said that obviously Andrews had given a false description to protect Shaw. But if Andrews had wanted to protect Clay Shaw, then why on earth had he given him the fake name of Clay Bertrand? Why hadn't he invented a fake first name for him as well as a fake second name? Garrison had an answer for that too. He said that when gay people want to conceal their identities, they, quote, always change their last names but never their first names. Shortly after he came up with his Clay Bertrand theory, Garrison took Dean Andrews to dinner at Broussard's again, and he triumphantly informed him that he'd worked out that Bertrand was Clay Shaw. Garrison invited Andrews to confirm this, but Andrews emphatically told him that he was wrong. The way Andrews described this scene later, he told Garrison that Clay Shaw was, quote, not in any way, shape, or form Clay Bertrand. Andrews did his very best to make this point clear because he was already quite alarmed by how greedily Garrison had seized on his made-up stories about Clay Bertrand. His apparently harmless little hospital room fantasies had really started to snowball. Unfortunately, though, Andrews wasn't alarmed enough yet to admit to Garrison that there was no such person as Clay Bertrand at all. He thought it would be enough to tell him very firmly that Bertrand just wasn't Clay Shaw. But this denial made no impression on Garrison. Garrison was already too far gone on his fantasy that Clay Bertrand was Shaw to let it go. He only wanted confirmation, as conspiracy theorists always do. Disconfirming evidence just couldn't penetrate his skull. Over the next couple of months, Garrison kept pestering Andrews to agree or admit that Bertrand was Shaw. As Andrews put it, Garrison, quote, attempted to brainwash him into saying this. We will ride to glory together, Garrison told him. But to Dean Andrews' credit, he never did tell Garrison what he wanted to hear. This is an important point for us to keep in mind. Dean Andrews did tell a lot of lies, and he changed his story many times, but he never told anyone at any time that Clay Bertrand and Clay Shaw were the same person. That idea came exclusively from the imagination of Jim Garrison. Later on, when Dean Andrews decided to start making public statements about Clay Bertrand's identity, he was quite clear about it. Bertrand was not Clay Shaw. Here's some audio of Andrews making this clear to a reporter.
Man, I wouldn't know Clay Shaw if a fella crossed him on the street dead.
Can you say positively that the person you knew as Clay Bertrand is not the person you have seen as Clay Shaw?
Scout's honor, he is not.
Scout's honor, he is not, Andrews said there at the end. But Andrews didn't start making public statements about Clay Shaw until the middle of 1967, after Garrison had arrested Shaw and laid conspiracy charges against him. To start with, Andrews thought it would be enough to tell Garrison in private that he was barking up the wrong tree. But Garrison refused to take Andrews' word for that. On Christmas Eve 1966, Garrison brought Clay Shaw into the DA's office to ask him some questions. Shaw came in without a lawyer because he didn't realise that he was being treated as a suspect. He thought that he was only helping Garrison with his inquiries. Garrison's investigators asked Shaw if he'd ever met Oswald or David Ferry, and he said that he hadn't. They asked him if he knew Clay Bertrand, and Shaw replied that he'd never even heard of him. The interview didn't last long, and Jim Garrison was pleasantly surprised by Shaw's apparent honesty. When they were done, Garrison thanked Shaw profusely for being a good cooperative citizen, and he sent him on his way. And then Garrison did something extremely uncharacteristic. He admitted that he'd been wrong. He told his staff to, quote, forget Shaw. Shaw obviously was not Bertrand, and he hadn't had anything to do with David Ferry's conspiracy. Garrison made the same admission to those journalists who he'd been talking Clay Shaw up to as a promising suspect. He told them now that Shaw had had, quote, absolutely nothing to do with President Kennedy's assassination. Shaw himself walked away from that Christmas Eve interview with Garrison, believing that his own little brush with the assassination story was over. He wrote in his diary that, quote, it was perhaps unfortunate that I did not know Oswald, because then I might possibly have been a tiny footnote in history. So how did Clay Shaw go from being not even a footnote in the assassination story on December the 24th to being the only person in history ever criminally charged over the assassination on March the 1st? How did Jim Garrison go from telling people to forget about Shaw on Christmas Eve to charging him with conspiracy just over 2 months later? What changed over the course of those 2 months? Did Garrison perhaps discover some sensational new piece of evidence against Shaw that compelled him to rethink his position? I think we know Garrison well enough by now to know that the answer was hell no. The only meaningful difference between December the 24th, 1966, and March the 1st, 1967, was that in December, David Ferry was still alive. Garrison still had some other poor sod to think of as his prime suspect, so he could afford to let himself see that Clay Shaw was innocent. But in late February, Ferry abruptly dropped dead, and Garrison immediately held that fateful press conference where he announced that he'd, quote, positively solved the assassination of President Kennedy, and that arrests and convictions were on the way. When Garrison made those rash comments, the world believed them, and millions of people now were waiting for him to deliver those promised arrests and convictions. In the DA's office, emergency meetings were held to decide who should now succeed David Ferry as Garrison's prime suspect. A number of possible candidates were talked about. Some of them were friends and associates of Ferry. Others were prominent New Orleans citizens. There was a nationally known doctor, a prominent hotel owner, and the president of a food processing company. But ultimately, Jim Garrison decided that he was going to retrieve Clay Shaw from his discard pile and dust him off and make him the new prime suspect. This shows us how little Garrison must have had on all those other possible suspects, because he had nothing on Shaw except for the fact that his first name was Clay. He also had the small problem of Dean Andrews. Andrews was the only person in the world who claimed to know Clay Bertrand, and he had consistently told Garrison that Bertrand was not Clay Shaw. So if Garrison did ever press charges against Shaw, Andrews seemed highly unlikely to testify for the prosecution. It seemed likelier that he would testify for the defence. What Garrison desperately needed was to find some other witness who not only claimed to know Clay Bertrand, but would be willing to agree that Clay Bertrand was Clay Shaw. Since Clay Bertrand didn't even exist, this would seem to have been quite a tall order. But a couple of days after David Ferry's death, Garrison had what appeared to be an amazing stroke of luck. This man came forward and started telling the press that he had new information about Kennedy's murder.
When Dave Ferry died, the name, I still doubted if it was the same guy. They said it's just another Dave Ferry, but when I saw his picture in the paper, then I knew it was the same man, and I had just as well say something to someone. And I wrote the district attorney the next day, and he should have gotten it Friday, and I saw the pictures this week.
That's a 25-year-old insurance salesman named Perry Russo speaking to a TV reporter 2 days after David Ferry's death. Russo told the reporter that he'd just written a letter to Jim Garrison's office explaining that he'd been a friend of the late David Ferry and had information to offer that might or might not be valuable to Garrison's investigation. According to Russo, Ferry had often spoken about what a good idea it would be to murder President Kennedy. Russo claimed that on more than one occasion he'd heard Ferry say, quote, "We will get him and it won't be long."
In late September or during October, months right prior to the Kennedy assassination in November, Dave Ferry had occasion to come over to the house on several instances, and I went to his place and just passing, and he made specific references that, in talking about Kennedy, he said, "We will get him, and it won't be very long." Now, the last time I can remember him saying that was sometime in October, but he was obsessed with that idea.
Like a lot of people in this subplot of the assassination story, Perry Russo was a member of New Orleans' sexual underground, although he was bisexual rather than gay. Russo had been a friend of David Ferry. That part of his story was true. They'd met when Ferry was working as an instructor for the Civil Air Patrol. Their relationship had gotten off to a rocky start. A young male friend of Russo's had fallen under Ferry's spell, as Russo phrased it, and Russo had intervened to save the kid from being corrupted. But after that bumpy start, Russo and Ferry became friendly. They had partnered up to distribute porno films imported from Cuba, and Russo had often been a visitor at Ferry's apartment. To begin with, Perry Russo didn't seem like an ideal witness for Jim Garrison. By the time Russo came forward to say incriminating things about David Ferry, Ferry was dead, and Garrison had no real need anymore for evidence against him. What he craved now was evidence against Clay Shaw. He badly needed to find some sort of link between Shaw and Oswald, or failing that, between Shaw and Ferry. Since no such links existed in real life, it became clear after just a couple of days that Garrison was going to have to do one of two things. Either he was going to have to abandon his investigation of Shaw for a second time, or he was going to have to start massaging the evidence so that it seemed to implicate Shaw. And that's exactly what Garrison started doing once Perry Russo had come on the scene. Russo was an eager young puppy dog of a witness. He was eager to please and very flexible. And since he'd already shown a willingness to make wildly improbable claims about the late David Ferry, maybe he would also be willing to make wildly improbable claims about the still-living Clay Shaw. On February the 25th, the day after Russo made those comments on TV that we just heard, Russo was interviewed by one of Garrison's assistant DAs, a guy named Andrew Chambray. Chambray showed Russo a photo of Lee Harvey Oswald and asked if he'd ever met him. Russo said that Oswald looked a bit like a roommate that David Ferry had once had, although he added that this roommate had been, quote, "a typical beatnik with his hair all messed up, a bushy beard, and dirty blonde hair." In other words, this roommate really didn't look anything like Lee Harvey Oswald. Then Chambray showed Russo a photo of Clay Shaw and asked if he recognised him. Russo replied that he'd never met this man, but believed that he may have seen him twice from a distance. Once at the Nashville Street Wharf when John F. Kennedy was giving a speech there, and once sitting in a car with David Ferry at a gas station that Ferry owned. That little nugget was music to Jim Garrison's ears, but he wanted more. So 2 days later, he brought Russo in for another interview, and this time before the interview, Garrison got Russo to agree to be injected with a dose of a drug called sodium pentothal. At the time, a lot of people believed that sodium pentothal was some kind of truth serum. If you gave people a dose of it, they would supposedly magically tell you the truth. We know now that that isn't the case. Really, all that sodium pentothal does is lower people's inhibitions and make them more suggestible. Perry Russo wasn't the only potential witness that Garrison shot up with sodium pentothal as he tried to build his case against Clay Shaw. And when he was challenged about his use of this voodoo technique later, Garrison used a weird word to defend it. He said that he used sodium pentothal to, quote, objectify the testimony of his witnesses. In other words, Garrison thought that the stories his witnesses told him when they were full of sodium pentothal were more scientifically objective and reliable than the stories they told him when they were just sitting there under the influence of nothing. Here's some audio of Garrison trying to explain this point.
Why do you feel that you've had to use extraordinary methods like truth drugs and hypnotism to get these people to give their evidence?
We decided to give him objectifying machinery to make sure he was telling the truth. We gave him the truth serum in order to make sure. Now, it seems to me that this is rather unusual. A prosecuting office, which has a pretty good case, making its witness take objectifying tests to make sure they're telling the truth. We did it for this reason. We used hypnosis for the same thing, just to make sure that he was telling the truth.
As usual, Garrison wasn't telling the truth there. He didn't use sodium pentothal and hypnosis to confirm stories that his witnesses had already told him under normal conditions. He used these methods to get his witnesses to change the stories that they'd told him under normal conditions. Because when Garrison's witnesses were not either heavily medicated or in a trance, they had an annoying habit of not telling him what he wanted to hear. When Garrison's office had interviewed Perry Russo the first time, his story had been mildly helpful, but nowhere near helpful enough. But when he was re-interviewed with the aid of sodium pentothal, his story suddenly acquired some very helpful new details. Under the influence of sodium pentothal, Russo was asked if he remembered having ever seen a man named Clay Bertrand at Ferry's apartment, and Russo said, yes, he did recall being introduced to a man named Bertrand at Ferry's apartment. He said the man was tall, with kinky white hair, and was sort of slender. In other words, the man looked just like the photo of Clay Shaw that Garrison's office had already showed him. Russo said that this Bertrand person was, quote, a queer, and he said that Bertrand had been present at Ferry's apartment one night when Ferry said, we are going to kill John F. Kennedy. It won't be long. As Russo later admitted, when Garrison's staff questioned him under the influence of sodium pentothal, he wasn't totally out of it. He was conscious enough to understand what was wanted from him. He told a reporter, quote, they asked me a lot of questions. I could figure out what they wanted to know. Once Perry Russo arrived on the scene then, things started moving very fast for Jim Garrison's investigation. It was now just 3 days since Garrison had promised the press that David Ferry's death wouldn't stop him from pursuing other suspects, and now, thanks to the magic of sodium pentothal and some grossly leading questions, Perry Russo had said that a man named Clay Bertrand, who looked a hell of a lot like Clay Shaw, was present at Ferry's apartment when Ferry talked about the imminent murder of President Kennedy. But before Garrison could take Perry Russo's story to the bank, he wanted one more thing from him. He wanted Russo to ID Clay Shaw as Clay Bertrand in person. So on February the 28th, the day after Russo's truth serum interview, one of Garrison's investigators drove Russo to Shaw's house. Russo went up and rang the doorbell, and when Shaw answered the door, Russo pretended that he was selling insurance in the neighbourhood. Shaw told him that he wasn't interested, and Russo returned pretty quickly to the car, and when he got back to the car, he told Garrison's investigator what he wanted to hear. Shaw was Bertrand. He was the man who'd been present in Ferry's apartment when Ferry had talked about murdering the president. The very next day, Garrison arrested Clay Shaw and charged him with having conspired with two other men, Oswald and Ferry, to murder John F. Kennedy. That charge was based solely on the claims of Perry Russo, which were so problematic that I haven't even scratched the surface yet of explaining everything that was wrong with them. But just for the moment, let's pause to savour one particularly enormous thing that was wrong with Russo's story. If Russo had indeed met Clay Shaw in Ferry's apartment when Ferry was discussing the homicide of the president, then Shaw would have instantly recognised Russo when he knocked on his door posing as an insurance salesman. That didn't happen, which meant that Russo's doorstep ID of Clay Shaw was essentially self-refuting. The fact that Jim Garrison didn't seem to notice this huge logical problem shows us how far the man had already drifted from the basic laws of reality. We do have to keep reminding ourselves, as we move through the story of Jim Garrison's investigation, that all this stuff did really happen. I'm not describing the plot of a Coen Brothers movie or a Marx Brothers movie. I'm talking about events that actually happened, and they happened because of conspiracy theory. They happened because Jim Garrison had read all those conspiratorial books about the assassination and was deluded enough to believe that all their claims were true and that they described an actual injustice that cried out to be corrected in the real world. Speaking of logical problems, Garrison still had the rather hefty problem of Dean Andrews to think about. Andrews had started this whole mess by claiming that someone called Bertrand had hired him to represent Oswald, but he was still steadfastly refusing to say that Bertrand was Clay Shaw. Garrison had tried to charm Andrews into changing his mind, but that hadn't worked. Now that the more flexible Perry Russo was telling Garrison all these wonderfully incriminating things about Clay Shaw that Andrews had refused to tell him, Garrison could afford to take a harder line with his old law school friend. He took Andrews to dinner one last time, and he cut a deal with him. If Andrews still refused to confirm that Shaw was Bertrand, and he did, then at least he had to agree to keep his mouth shut and to refrain from telling people that Shaw wasn't Bertrand. Dean Andrews agreed to that deal, although deal was really the wrong word for it, since Andrews didn't get anything out of it. It was more a matter of what Garrison would do to him if he didn't keep his mouth shut. As Andrews put it later, Garrison threatened to send him to the Bastille if he said anything in public to compromise Garrison's case against Shaw. "The Jolly Green Giant was going to pounce on me like a 1,000-pound canary," Andrews said. So Andrews agreed to stay silent, at least for the moment. He feared what Garrison would do to him if he didn't, and as we'll see later, he was right to fear him. When Garrison arrested Clay Shaw on March the 1st, he did so in a typically publicity-hungry way. Instead of just calling Shaw and asking him to come in for another interview, Garrison issued a subpoena, compelling him to appear for questioning. This fact was leaked to the press and was being reported on the radio before Shaw himself had heard anything about it. The first thing he knew about it was when he found some sheriff's men on his doorstep whom Garrison had sent around to bring him in. When he arrived at Garrison's office, Shaw was grilled for 2.5 hours about his supposed connections with Oswald and David Ferry. One of Garrison's investigators said to him, "What would you say if we told you that we have 3 witnesses who could positively identify you as having been in Ferry's apartment and in Ferry's gas station?" When Shaw replied that these witnesses were either mistaken or they were lying, he was asked to take a truth serum test to verify his story. "Why on earth should I?" Shaw said. And Garrison's investigator replied, "If you don't, we're going to charge you with conspiring to murder the President of the United States." "You've got to be kidding," Shaw said. But of course Garrison wasn't kidding. He proceeded to slap a pair of handcuffs on Shaw, and he ordered that he should be now taken downstairs to be charged. Shaw could have been taken downstairs in Garrison's private elevator, but instead Garrison took him out through the hallway, which was crammed with reporters and TV crews, who Garrison had tipped off in advance. So footage of Shaw being shoved through the crowd in handcuffs duly appeared on the TV news that night. When Perry Russo heard that Shaw had been arrested, his reaction was very interesting. He said to one of Garrison's assistant DAs, "My God, don't tell me that they've arrested that man on what I said. I could have been wrong," he said. "I could have been mistaken." So this is how reliable the testimony of Garrison's star witness was. The star witness himself didn't even really believe his own story. After Clay Shaw was charged, he was released on bond, and the next day he and his lawyers held a press conference at which he vigorously protested his innocence.
"I am completely innocent of any such charges. I have not conspired with anyone at any time or any place to murder our late and esteemed President John F. Kennedy or any other individual. I have always had only the highest and utmost respect and admiration for Mr. Kennedy. The charges filed against me have no foundation in fact or in law. I have not been apprised of the basis of these fantastic charges, and assume that in due course I will be furnished with this information and will be afforded an opportunity to prove my innocence. I did not know Harvey Lee Oswald, nor did I ever see or talk with him or anyone who knew him at any time in my life."
The same day Shaw held that press conference, Jim Garrison made an announcement that took everybody by surprise. People were expecting Garrison to secure an indictment against Shaw in the usual way, by presenting evidence to a grand jury in a closed session. But instead of doing that, Garrison announced that he wanted to hold a preliminary hearing, which would take place in an open courtroom in front of a panel of three judges. This wasn't legally necessary, and it was highly unorthodox. Preliminary hearings were rare, and if any side requested them, it was usually the defense. In Garrison's words, it was virtually unheard of for the state to request a preliminary hearing, because it meant that Garrison would now have to tip his hand and reveal the evidence that he had against Shaw before he went to trial. When Garrison was asked why he'd taken this unusual step, he explained that he wanted to, quote, "lean over backward and give the defendant every chance." But that, of course, was a lie. Garrison wasn't remotely interested in justice or in being fair to Clay Shaw. He was interested in himself. He saw the case as his ticket to national fame. He'd told people that if he handled the case right, he might end up as governor of Louisiana, or maybe win a seat in the US Senate. In one feverish moment, he'd told somebody that he might even end up in the White House. By arresting Clay Shaw, Garrison had put himself in the national spotlight, and he liked it there, and he wanted to stay there. And holding an open pre-trial hearing would keep the publicity rolling in. Before he went ahead with the preliminary hearing, Garrison made a fairly definitive effort to deal with the problem of Dean Andrews. He took the extraordinary step of threatening to charge Andrews with perjury unless he agreed to say on the record that Bertrand and Shaw were the same person. For a practicing lawyer like Andrews, this was a serious threat. A perjury conviction would end his legal career. On the face of it, this sounds like an outrageously unethical threat for Garrison to have made. It definitely seems a bit off for a district attorney to threaten people with perjury charges unless they testify the way he wants them to. And yet, there's no question that Garrison did make this threat to Andrews, because Garrison himself proudly boasts about it in his book On the Trail of the Assassins. In his book, Garrison describes taking Andrews to dinner at Broussard's and pressuring him to admit that the man he knew as Clay Bertrand was Clay Shaw. In the book, Andrews says to Garrison, "How can I convince you that I don't know this cat? I don't know what he looks like, and I don't know where he's at." And Garrison replies, "I want you to know that I'm going to call you in front of the grand jury. If you lie to the grand jury as you've been lying to me, I'm going to charge you with perjury. And then Garrison writes, read my lips. Either you dance in to the grand jury with the real moniker of that cat who called you to represent Lee Oswald, or your fat behind is going to the slammer. Do you dig me? You might be wondering why on earth Garrison would brag so openly in his own book about doing something that seems so obviously unethical. My answer is that, like any pure conspiracy theorist, Garrison was genuinely delusional. He was by now thoroughly convinced in his own mind that Clay Bertrand was Clay Shaw. From Garrison's point of view, the fact that Dean Andrews refused to agree with this proposition could only mean one thing. Andrews was lying to protect Shaw. And since Andrews was so clearly lying, that meant that anything Garrison did to force Andrews to admit that Bertrand and Shaw were the same person must be ethically and morally correct. Garrison was exhibiting what I think of as a defining trait of the pure conspiracy theorist. Because his picture of reality was completely upside down, his moral sense had flipped upside down too. If black was white, in this case, as Garrison himself had defiantly announced, then wrong must be right. He could give himself permission to behave in all sorts of appalling and abysmal and apparently unethical ways, because in his mind, it was all being done in the name of a cause that was correct and just. Garrison's threat to charge Andrews with perjury was not an empty one. Straight after he arrested Clay Shaw, Garrison started to follow through on the threat. He didn't summon Andrews to appear before the grand jury, at least not yet, but he did use his subpoena power to summon Andrews to his office, and he asked him on the record if Shaw was Bertrand. Andrews had no real choice but to give the non-committal reply that Garrison had made him agree to give, according to that deal they'd made. That is, he replied that he couldn't say that Shaw was Bertrand, but he couldn't say that he wasn't either. Now that Andrews had said this on the record, Garrison had the ammunition to charge him with lying under oath if he subsequently decided to say anything else. In other words, Andrews was now neutralized. Garrison could move ahead with the pre-trial hearing without having to worry that Andrews would say anything in public to compromise his case. Dean Andrews was no fool. He could see now that Garrison wasn't to be trusted on the topic of Clay Shaw. Garrison had either gone completely insane, or else he'd consciously decided to arrest and charge a man he knew to be innocent. So Andrews decided to do a little experiment to test just how on the level Jim Garrison was. The story of this little trick that Dean Andrews played on Garrison is complicated, but it's well worth telling because it's one of the most hilarious subplots in this whole bizarre story. It's unclear exactly when Andrews set this subplot in motion. It seems to have begun at least a week before Clay Shaw's arrest. But anyway, what Andrews did was he invented out of thin air the names of two men who he said might well have been involved in the conspiracy that Garrison seemed to believe in so fervently. And then he sat back and waited to see what Garrison would do with these two names. The names that Andrews invented were Manuel Garcia Gonzalez and Ricardo Davis. Andrews told Garrison that these men were Cuban guerrilla fighters and possible associates of Lee Harvey Oswald. As Andrews put it later, he invented two bum names out of my head on the spur of the moment to see if the giant is kosher. Here's some audio of a fairly dumbfounded reporter getting Andrews to explain this little stunt of his later on.
Did he ask you if you knew any of the people involved?
I think he did.
What'd you tell him?
Manny Garcia Gonzalez and Ricardo Davis.
Did you know Mr. Gonzalez?
No.
Did you know Mr. Davis?
No.
Where did you get those names?
Out the air.
In other words, these names were fictional as far as you were concerned?
Well, I'm trying to see if his cat's kosher, you know.
So what?
So he's kosher. I don't know.
So you just picked two names out of the air?
Right.
Now, why did you do that?
Well, I don't know what he's up to. He's picking me like chicken, shucking me like corn, stewing me like an oyster. I mean, he ain't put nothing down but air. So I'll give him two names, see which way he's going.
In other words, you made up two names to see what he was going to do with them.
Right.
In case you didn't catch that last bit, what Andrew said there was, I'm trying to see if this cat's kosher. I don't know what he's up to. He's picking me like chicken, shucking me like corn, stewing me like an oyster. He ain't putting down nothing but air, so I give him two names, see which way he's going. Andrews was sick of getting messed around by Jim Garrison, so he decided that he was going to mess Jim Garrison around in return. And Garrison wound up taking the bait in a more spectacular and embarrassing way than Andrews could possibly have hoped for. You may recall that way back in episode 4 of this podcast, I talked about an incident where Oswald was filmed handing out pro-Castro leaflets on a street corner in New Orleans in the company of two mysterious men. The Warren Commission identified one of these men as an unemployed youth named Charles Steele Jr., who Oswald had paid $2 to for 15 minutes of his time. The identity of the second man has never been established. In all probability, he was just another random guy who Oswald found down at the unemployment office. But since his identity has never been established, the mystery of who this man was has always been catnip for conspiracy theorists. In 2020, for example, Donald Trump claimed that this mysterious associate of Oswald was none other than Ted Cruz's father. But decades before Trump made that asinine claim, Jim Garrison came up with his own equally baseless theory about the identity of this mystery man. According to Garrison, he was Manuel Garcia Gonzalez, the man that Dean Andrews had invented out of thin air. Having come to that conclusion, Garrison then set off on a hilarious wild goose chase to find this Manny Gonzalez. On the 26th of February 1967, the New York Times reported that Garrison was looking for a Cuban exile by that name, although, as the Times pointed out, the name Manuel Gonzalez was about as common in Cuba as the name John Smith was in America. The Times reported that Garrison had put out a warrant for the arrest of Gonzalez on narcotics charges and had ordered police to hold him on a $50,000 bond if they found him. When police questioned the size of that bond, Garrison explained that Gonzalez was also wanted for homicide. At a later point, Garrison announced that he'd identified Manuel Garcia Gonzalez as, quote, the trigger man in Kennedy's assassination. He told a reporter that he had a photograph that had been taken in Dealey Plaza just minutes before the assassination, which supposedly showed several Latino men standing behind the picket fence on the grassy knoll. Garrison said that one of these men was Manuel Garcia Gonzalez, who he now believed had fled the country. At one point, Garrison apparently went so far as to arrest somebody called Manuel Garcia Gonzalez. He confiscated a pistol from this man, which he then showed to Dean Andrews, which put Andrews in the weird position of having to wonder if Garrison had confiscated this pistol from a real man named Manuel Garcia Gonzalez, or if Garrison, for his own reasons, had now invented his own imaginary man with that name. Here's how Andrews described this bizarre scene later to a reporter.
About 2 weeks ago, on a Saturday, we were talking, and he picks up a weapon with an item number on it.
What kind of a weapon?
Pistol. Semi-automatic. Black. Probably 7.6 millimeter. I didn't examine it. And he says that Manny Garcia Gonzalez in Miami or someplace down there got busted for carrying a concealed weapon. And I told him Manny Garcia Gonzalez was never busted in his life. I didn't believe it. He put the weapon back down. We talked some more. And that was it. I left.
Did he tell you this was a gun taken from this man?
From Emmanuel Garcia Gonzalez. Now, I don't know if the Emmanuel Garcia Gonzalez he's talking about is for real? After Manny Garcia Gonzalez is the name that I pulled out of the air. This I cannot say.
What was your conclusion from that conversation?
Well, if it's the Manuel Garcia Gonzalez that I told him, he's got the right ta-ta, but the wrong ho-ho.
In April, just a month after he'd arrested Clay Shaw, Jim Garrison declared in a magazine article that he would gladly give up Clay Shaw if only he could get his hands on Kennedy's true assassin, Manuel Garcia Gonzalez. I've described this little bizarre subplot of the Garrison story for a number of reasons. First, it shows us how quickly Garrison's investigation degenerated into madness and farce. It also shows us how unbelievably cynical or mixed up Garrison's attitude to Clay Shaw was. Garrison had very publicly charged Shaw with conspiring to murder President Kennedy, a crime that could be punished by a 20-year term in prison. That was an extremely serious measure for a DA to take, and no respectable DA would have done it if he didn't honestly believe that the man he was charging was guilty. And yet just a month after charging him, Garrison didn't think there was anything wrong with publicly saying that he would gladly give Shaw up if he could only get his hands on the true assassin. In one part of Garrison's addled mind, Clay Shaw really did plot with David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald to murder the President of the United States, but in another part of his addled mind, Shaw was just a means to an end. The true assassin was somebody else, and Shaw was an instrument that Garrison could use to crack open the wider truth. The story of Jim Garrison's persecution and prosecution of Clay Shaw really is a sorry tale, and it's only going to get sorrier in the next episode when we look at what happened when Garrison tried to make his case in court. But I think we've already gone deep enough into this story to see that there's really only two alternative readings of Jim Garrison's character available to us. The man was either very, very mad, or he was very, very bad. Possibly he was both, but the idea that he was neither just doesn't fly. And the idea that he was some kind of American hero is obscene. You really do have to be a moral cretin to believe that. I think of Jim Garrison as a kind of Frankenstein's monster who was accidentally put together and activated by that first wave of Kennedy conspiracists, the Mark Lanes and the Harold Weisbergs and the Sylvia Mars. Once Garrison had lumbered into life, there was no stopping him, even though many of the conspiracy theorists themselves came to view him as a dangerous embarrassment and came to wish that he would just disappear. Garrison embodied in a very crude and garish way many of the big themes that have been running through this entire podcast. His story reminds us that all conspiracy theories, when you boil them down, are basically just an attempt to deny reality. And Garrison also reminds us that denying reality is a very dangerous thing to do. When you give yourself permission to ignore reality, as chronically as Garrison did, when you have that much contempt for objective fact and common sense, then it's not long before you acquire a contempt for common decency as well. To put it more simply, denying reality is an immoral act. And if you ask me, Jim Garrison's rampant, blatant cynicism and indecency were just a noisier version of the indecency that's run through all Kennedy conspiracy theory right from the start. Because right from the start, Kennedy conspiracy theory has been an attempt to deny or ignore the guilt of a phenomenally guilty man, which is a fundamentally immoral thing to do. We should never forget that the founding document of Kennedy conspiracy theory was written by a defense attorney. It was Mark Lane's Oswald Innocent, a Lawyer's Brief. From the moment Mark Lane wrote that article right down to the present day, Kennedy conspiracy theory has always based itself on one of two basic claims. Either Oswald didn't do it alone, or he didn't do it at all. But here's the thing. If you want to pursue either of those claims seriously, then pretty soon you find yourself having to come up with the names of the other people who were responsible for the president's murder, if Oswald wasn't. In practice, you can't defend a man who's that guilty without smearing and accusing people who are in fact innocent and had nothing to do with the crime. And that, again, is not a very moral or nice thing to do. Most conspiracy theories have this immoral blame-shifting structure when you look at them closely. The Japanese weren't to blame for the bombing of Pearl Harbor, for example. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed wasn't the true mastermind behind 9/11. Dick Cheney and George Bush were, and so on. But of course, in most conspiracy theories, these arraignments of the innocent are not literal arraignments. They don't take place in a courtroom. But in Jim Garrison's case, the arraignment and the prosecution were literal. There were going to be courtrooms, and a real man was going to be in the dock. In practice, Garrison's supposedly righteous Kennedy crusade became a grotesque exercise in accusing innocent human beings, more or less randomly, of having been involved in the conspiracy to kill Kennedy. First, Garrison accused David Ferry, who had the good fortune to die before Garrison could formally charge him, and then he went after Clay Shaw, who inconvenienced Garrison by remaining alive. That really put Garrison on the spot. He was now going to have to answer another question that lurks behind every conspiracy theory. How do you go about making a case when there's no real case to be made? That question began to be answered at Clay Shaw's preliminary hearing, which took place between March the 14th and 17th, 1967. And that's where we'll be picking up this story next time on The Ghosts of Dallas.
A preliminary hearing for Shaw was held 2 weeks after his arrest. The hearing was complete with a surprise mystery witness, Perry Raymond Russo, 25-year-old insurance salesman and friend of the late David Ferry. Through 3 days of intense cross-examination, Russo held doggedly to his story that he himself had been present when Shaw, Ferry, and Oswald plotted the Kennedy assassination. Russo admitted at the hearing that he had been hypnotized 3 times by Garrison men. A writer for the Saturday Evening Post said he read transcripts of what went on at those sessions. The writer suggested that Russo's entire performance at the hearing was the product of post-hypnotic suggestion.